This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
You know, you're a young gunner and you can sell a bunch of things. It doesn't mean you can be a leader. A leader is somebody that people actually want to follow and that actually helps their people and cares for their people and wants to help them grow their lives, right? Whereas the hustler is just like out there doing whatever's good for themselves and what can make the next dollar to pay the next cool thing.
Welcome back to the Color of Money podcast. Today, I'm joined with my awesome co-host, Bowman Keady and Miss Julia Lachey. And today, we got one of my buddies, Kobe Socher. I've known Kobe for, like 8 years now, 9 years now. And we've kind of grown up and learned this investment stuff. Obviously, you're doing it at a 10x level that I'm doing it at. But we've learned a lot of these things around the same time and kind of grown through this investment space together. Now, Kobe's a visionary CEO. He's the founder of Speedy Offers. It's a leading cash home buying and real estate investment company that's servicing the greater Cleveland area. Now, what Kobe does with this, Kobe grew up in real estate. He's a partner of the Socher team with Keller Williams Greater Metropolitan, and he helps clients navigate complexities of real estate transactions with the expertise and care. And he took that knowledge to go start an investment business. And so what we're going to be leaning in today and talking about a lot today with Kobe is how he got here, how his mind works with wanting to lean into this investment space, and then really how do we actually evaluate, see, and run through his deal hierarchy that all of us real estate professionals come across but don't actually look at it from an investment perspective. So I'm excited to have you, Kobe. I'm excited to jump in. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. You know, it reminds me of something you just said, which is that, you know, two things come to mind. One is that, you know, if you were a realtor in 2011, that's when I started, you learned how to do, you know, short sales, you learned how to deal with foreclosures, and you learned how to deal with investors. And then your investors are just like buying more and buying more and buying more. And over time, it was like, I was connecting these investors with lenders and I was connecting them with, you know, contractors. And they're like, hey, can you do a walkthrough video for me? And I'm doing all these things. And then I end up with just like this tiny piece of the pie. And looking back, you know, it felt cool because I was selling a ton of property, but I wasn't like building anything exciting for myself. And then I heard Brett Tanner at, you know, a conference in, 2015. And he said something that just hit me, which is he said, I believe that real estate agents should be the wealthiest people on the planet, but they're not.
Let's go all the way back, though. So before you got into this investment space, you started seeing the world differently. Tell us a little bit about how you got into real estate, what your sales business looked like prior to jumping into this investment in Speedy Offers.
Goes back to high school, right? Go to high school. I'm not the most academic human on earth. My family is. So my dad's, you know, was a college professor, has a PhD from Harvard, taught at Cal and Stanford. We moved to Ohio because he becomes the head of department at Oberlin College, which is a small liberal arts college in Northeast Ohio. And, you know, in high school, take a year abroad. My dad says, you know, like, I know you're thinking about going to college, but he's like, it's never too late to go back and get an education. And there's different ways of educating yourself. And, you know, maybe you want to get into sales. Your mom sold some houses. She's doing really well. My mom had been in the business since 2006. And he's like, maybe you get your real estate license and see if you like business, if that's what you're saying you want to get into before you just go to school for something. Because he said, I see a lot of college kids go to school, have no idea why they're going to school, what the purpose is of going to school, end up with some degree that they don't want to do that thing with. So he's like, by doing this, he's like, yeah, you'll defer first semester or two. But he's like, you'll never be 45 and wish you graduated a semester earlier. So I had this advice from like this college professor, my dad. I always respected my dad, loved my dad. You know, my parents were this awesome couple. And I was like, okay, I'm in for that. So come back from my year abroad, go literally straight into real estate school, have a really hard time passing my test because, again, my knowledge skills weren't there in terms of like the textbook side of things. But got my real estate license and just started selling houses right away. My mom was just willing to teach me everything. And I was willing to do anything. She's like, go to this house and do this. Listen to this phone call. Pick this thing up. And I was just like, well, and I kind of had that theory at the time that's like, well, what I have on my side is I could work a million hours. Like, you can't outwork me. And I would just get into that mindset of that. And then the other thing that I think helped me have some success is I had this deep belief that, like, I didn't want to do anything than the thing I was doing. So I had to, like, keep my blinders on. A lot of people, you know, like, you get in real estate and it's like, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. And, you know, you're like a gig person and all these things, and real estate's also a gig. And for me, it was like, if I'm doing it, I wanted to just be like blinders on just that. And so we start selling houses, you know, we're kind of selling them side by side. We're like, maybe we should join a team. We joined Keller Williams in 2013. Maybe we should start a team. You know, we needed admin support at that time. So we hired an admin and we kind of started growing our team. We've gone through different renditions, probably as we all have, of our teams. And, you know, I think I bought my first house in 2013. I bought my second house in 2015. They were like some rentals here and there. And I would always just find ways to buy them. Right? Like, I would just get really creative on how to buy something with somebody else's credit or somebody else's thing. You know, that kind of concept of OPM, other people's money, right? And from there, though, it was always just the hustle. Even as we had a team, it felt like I was just hustling always. And I wanted to get out at some point of that hustler side of things and have something to really look back at, because I was buying fancy things, right? Like, I had some watches, I had a cool car, I was on some cool vacations, you know, like, I had the look of it. But if you actually, like, were to dig deep and look back, you'd realize there really wasn't anything there. And so even all the awards and all the accolades that I was getting at the time, you know, if you're 23 selling $20, $30, $40 million in real estate, I was getting 30 under 30 and this thing and that thing and all these exciting things. But I kept feeling like almost this imposter syndrome of like, but I don't actually have a net worth. I didn't even know what my net worth was, by the way. And so, you know, by actually hiring the right coach and taking my life and myself seriously, it helped me evolve into kind of a really complex, cool world that I run now.
Well, I think that's such a trap that we fall into in the real estate industry, is we fall in love with, whether it be the accolades or the volume or the GCI, and we're not putting enough emphasis on, am I building wealth? Am I truly using this as a gateway to build my network, to build my cash flow? And it's why I wanted to have you on today, because I think that transition for you, we've had a lot of authentic conversations, and that transition for you to recognize it, see it, and pivot, and then explode this investment business has been super inspirational, dude.
Kobe, you talked about that moment where you said, Brett Tanner said to you, you know, real estate agents should be the wealthiest people on the planet, but they're not. And you said that hit really hard. I'd be interested in, like, what hit for you at that time. Like, I'm assuming that was around this time. Like, what resonated with you in this moment that made you think, oh, that makes sense to me, and it's not playing itself out in my life, that inspired the change for you?
I think it was getting pregnant with our first son, right? I think my wife and I were both professionals, you know, so my wife's working, I'm working, you can kind of run this life and you can keep it going, right? But, like, it was the classic rat race that you know about, right? It's like the thing that everybody talks about. Like, we're just on this spinning wheel. And like, I had to keep making money to keep up with my Mercedes and to keep up with the expenses. I wanted to find a way to have actually a real life and a bigger life and to grow a legacy. And I didn't want to just be that Kobe had to be the Kobe hustler that he always was. And I wanted to go from being the hustler to a CEO. And I could pretend I was a CEO, but I wasn't a CEO.
For those of you who can see on YouTube, maybe you're watching this on YouTube, behind Kobe, he's got this Monopoly character up there. And when you're talking about going from the rat race and the hustle and to actually buying investments and being purposeful, it reminds me of this saying that I keep seeing all over social media about Monopoly. It says, imagine playing Monopoly and never buying assets or investments that generate income. You just keep going around collecting $200, giving your money to the rich and trying to stay out of jail. That's how most people live their lives. And so I'm looking at you behind, you know, sitting in front of this Monopoly picture and talking about literally how you decided to not live that life and that quote that's going around all over social media by actually being intentional and getting a coach and getting focused and deciding you were going to live an intentional life. It's a really cool story you're sharing.
I think that I went so rich dad, poor dad at the beginning of, like, my mindset was just of abundance. Like, oh, I could sell endless amounts and grow my team endlessly, and I'll just make endless amounts of money and it'll never stop. And then you have a couple slow quarters, like, oh, wow, this is weird, right? And it's like, I don't have a belief that I love either Dave Ramsey or Rich Dad Poor Dad, but sometimes I feel like you need to go the Dave Ramsey route before you can be Rich Dad Poor Dad, right? So I had to, like, straighten up, make sure I, like, okay, no credit card bills, no, like, you know, I owned rentals, but also had some credit card debt. So I'm making 12% on my rentals on a good day. My credit card debt has, you know, a 27% APR. It's like, well, who's making money here? It's not me.
Right. You talked about that transition, right? Going through the transition from sort of hustler to CEO. Can you tell us a little bit of like how you see Kobe the hustler versus how you see Kobe the CEO?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as a hustler, we're always just trying to find that next thing to eat, right? So we're just running at things and there's not really an intention behind it. And, you know, it's also maybe the leadership skills weren't there, right? You know, you're a young gunner and you can sell a bunch of things. It doesn't mean you can be a leader. A leader is somebody that people actually want to follow and that actually helps their people and cares for their people and wants to help them grow their lives, right? Whereas the hustler is just like out there doing whatever's good for themselves and what can make the next dollar to pay the next cool thing.
Yeah, it's a world that we live in far too often, unfortunately, in our industry.
Even with him saying about what a leader is, because some people just say, I want to lead a team. I want to be the CEO. I want to be the team leader, the OP, the whatever it is, because they like the title of it and not understanding what you just said and described the actual leader to be.
Yeah, and that's something you have to grow, right? I mean, it's like there's natural abilities to lead, but there's also intention and just hours that need to be put in order to get there.
Well, when we transitioned from being a wildly successful real estate agent, getting a coach, understanding this investment space, wanting to start building more of a legacy, I dropped that word for Unc because I know he wants to talk about it on every episode. So tell us a little bit about Speedy Offers. Like what do you do? What is that deal hierarchy? A lot of agents have deals that come across their desk every day that they go and list, and you made the pivot to having listing it be literally the last thing that we want to do, right?
Can I pull back for 1 second before there?
Yeah, for sure.
For me, it started with, so it was hiring the right person and then it was doing the work. Doing the work was building out a 30-year net worth plan. Like, what is Kobe? What do you want to be worth in 30 years? Like, actually, like, what do you want your life to look like? Like, what do you want your legacy to be in 30 years from now? Mm. Now, what are you worth today? So like, you have to have a balance sheet, a net worth tracker of like, what is actually on there and what are you worth today? And by the way, when you don't have a lot, it's scary to do that. It's like when the bank account's high, you're willing to look at it every day. And then when it starts getting a little lower, right? You like, you hide from it. You don't want to look at it. Or when credit cards bills start going up, all of a sudden you're not logging into your Chase app, right? When it's real low and you're just looking at points, it's all exciting, right? Yeah. And so what are you actually worth today? So what do you want to be worth 30 years from now? What are you worth today? Now, what would it take to get there? And I think that's the game is like, what would it take to get there? Now with that, now we have something to track against, right? And so if you're a highly motivated person and a competitive person, like you can find people to compete against in business, but like, I'm not competing against you, Daniel. I'm competing against myself. It's my life. It's what I want. I probably don't want what you want. Yeah. Right. And so how do we actually go and get there? And so to me, that was the game. And originally, you know, Brett Tanner talks about building out a $50 million net worth plan. And I did it. And I realized to build $50 million, all I needed was two homes a year worth $250,000 each, buying at somewhere between a 3% and 6% interest rate, right? Putting 20% down payments on them and just letting them ride for 30 years. And after 30 years, it'd be worth $50 million. And I go, that's not exciting. That's not exciting at all. That's easy, right?
Right.
Like that would be a disappointment. So I built out a net worth plan to be worth $350 million in 30 years. And by doing that, it created a massive legacy. And by the way, what it is it's actually $250 million for me and $100 million for my family. By building that out, that was a scary number. Now I have something I can go run at. Now I can go, I can quote unquote hustle towards that. But to get there, by the way, I couldn't be a hustler. You can't hustle your way to $350 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's just not possible now. So now I got to go figure out how to be a man, how to grow up, how to be a leader, how to be a CEO, how to be an owner and an operator that can actually go and get towards something that's like really big and scary.
So Kobe, in that exercise, you just said something that's really interesting is like when you set a goal, a net worth or a wealth goal, there are certain goals you can't hustle your way to. Yet we're in a business that, you know, rewards hustle. And quite frankly, in real estate sales, you can hustle your way to a really good living, right?
Oh, yeah.
But implicit in what you just said is that there's a cap, that there's a limit to what that hustle. And when you made that, so two questions, how do you see that limit to the hustle? It seems like you had the privilege of seeing that really early on in your life. So you were able to say, okay, I can make this pivot. And when you made the pivot, did you actually step back?
I would say two things, though. Like, don't lose your urgency. My urgency didn't go down for what I want in life. But, you know, certain hustle may have, because you had to allow other people to jump in and actually run really, really hard. I definitely think that, you know, you make big decisions during maybe a down moment or a different moment, right? Like, things get a little weird and you're like, okay, things need to change a little bit. But I don't think my want and energy and drive and need and urgency changed. But I definitely think the running at whatever seemed like the shiniest thing changed, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think it would make now sense to just, you know, after talking about that, kind of building that background of like why I want to go to where I want to go, then it was like, okay, well, how do we actually get there? And I was like, well, what do I know best? So it's like, Daniel, if you ask me like, hey, Kobe, like, what do you know best? It's like, well, it's not very sexy, but it's mediocre homes in Greater Cleveland. It's like, that's what I know best. Like, you're laughing, but it's reality, right? It's what we all know best in our neighborhoods, yeah, right? Yeah, so it's like, yeah. I grew up in the business. My mom's the business. I always like, you know, idolized my mom for what she did. I thought it was so cool, and she worked so hard and had created such a cool life for us. But then I get into it from an 18-year-old's perspective, and what I know best are mediocre homes in my area. So instead of figuring out, like, I think there's this element of like, do I need to go do something else? Do I need to become an investment banker? Do I need to become a this? Do I need to go into that? Like, is it a crypto? Like, what's the thing that's like, you know, do I have to find something else to get to where I want to go? I was like, well, what do I know best? And it's like, well, what I know best are super mediocre homes. And by the way, these are not very exciting homes. If you realize what I'm telling you, what I know, like, this is not a very exciting thing. And yet, if we could skin the cat in a different way than just a commission, we can get some really, really, really cool things to happen. So now we get into like the deal hierarchy, right? And we go, instead of saying like, okay, this property comes up, can I list it? Now the question is like, how do I control the deal, right? So can I buy it? Well, if I buy it, can I wholesale it and make a $15,000 profit? Could I do a wholetail, which is where you just buy it, clean it up maybe with a cleaning person, a landscaper, put it right back in the market, maybe within a week? And can I make $37,500 from that deal? Could I buy it and do a full flip where I would need to net a minimum of $50,000 per deal? Could I do a rental where I want to net $500 to $600 per deal depending on the deal? Could I do a long-term owner finance note where I buy it, put it back on the market, offer long-term owner financing? And could I net a minimum of $750 per month? Or could I list the home? And so you start looking at the same asset class that we all know best. I don't know storage. I don't know multifamily. I don't know commercial. I don't know these things the way I know a single family home in Northeast Ohio. It's just what I'm really comfortable with. I've been in a million inspections. I've sold a lot of them. It's just what I know. I've lived in them, right? And so how do we then go take that thing and just flip it on its head so that, you know, we can get it done? By the way, I'm doing this while still helping a seller, because we still give them all the options. Like, what makes most sense for you? Do you want to click the easy button and just get a quick cash offer? Or like, does it make most sense to get like market value and sell it, you know, on the market with our real estate team? Like, what's the best for you? And you'd be surprised how many people would rather an offer at 20 to 40% below market value for you to just take it off their hands and not have to deal with it anymore.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit hometeam.com to learn more.
One thing you said, you went through that hierarchy really clearly and you had your numbers defined. And I think that for a lot of investors, they don't necessarily, and this is a big pitfall I made, I didn't really have a buy box.
Exactly.
I didn't really have a if this, then this. Uh-huh. It was, that deal looks good. I know this area. It'll sell for more later. Don't worry about it.
Let's get even more nitty gritty, right? This is just, I'm just going to rip off the head. So here's my buy box. Single family home, half an acre or less of land, not on a busy street, 3 to 4 bedrooms, not a 2 bedroom, not a 5 bedroom, right? 1 to 3 bathrooms, must have a basement. Right? Like, built after 1950. You get really clear in your buy box of what do I think is the best thing? Like, here's exactly what I want. So by having that buy box, now we can just go run exactly inside of it. Also, helps me analyze deals at a way better, you know, I can market for that. I can do all these different things. Now, what happens if something comes in outside of the buy box? Well, then it maybe only fits inside of the deal hierarchy of the wholesale. Okay, mm-hmm. That's a wholesale. Let some other investor deal with it.
Well, how did you identify the buy box, though?
You could look at your market and say, well, what moves the most? What rents really easily? Like, that rents really easily, right? 3 to 4 bedrooms, 1 to 3 bathrooms, rents really easily on a non-busy street with not a ton of acreage and land, so you have a bunch of landscaping to deal with, right? After 1950s, it means that it's going to be like an actual foundation, meaning it's not going to be like, you know, paper mache and rocks or whatever like those old foundations have. So it's just kind of refining like what moves the most in your market.
Now, when you think about having this hierarchy, let's run through it again. So you have the wholesale option.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have your investors that you sell these potential deals to, right?
Yep.
Cool. You have your wholesale option. So yep. We acquire the property, we clean it up, we put it back on the market. We have
full flip.
A full flip.
Can you go into order? So the first one was a light flip. Is one a light flip?
Wholesale, right?
I'm going to call the first one a wholesale, like an assignment deal. Yeah.
Which, by the way, can you just describe what that even is? I know we're using these terms, but we do have a lot of listeners that don't even know what you mean by wholesaling. Yeah.
Okay. So a wholesale essentially is like this. You get under contract for a property. So I buy a property from Daniel under contract for $100,000. That contract allows me to sign that property. I then market that property out and Bo, you know, reaches out to me and say, I'd like to buy that property. I then assign Daniel's contract to Bo for $110,000. At which point at closing through escrow, I get paid a $10,000 assignment fee.
How much of your own capital do you need in that kind of transaction, Kobe?
Pretty much zero.
Right. It's a great way for agents.
It's why people are doing it. I mean, you know, I would say that you might need earnest money, but not always. Usually the end buyer puts in the earnest money. So Bo, in this case, would be putting in, let's say, $1,000 of earnest money.
What's exciting about this too is when you go the next step that, I mean, Brett always adds so many different layers to this, but the earnest money coming out of a self-directed IRA, so the wholesale fee goes back in the self-directed that's untaxed, is a total magician's play on how to continue to grow these tax-free entities to prepare for retirement. Really, really cool.
Oh yeah, I mean, you can go wild with it. Again, it just depends on where you are in your career and your business. But just to give you an idea, in 2024, we did, you know, over $650,000 of assignments.
You were going in an order and I interrupted you, Kobe. Yeah. You were saying wholesale.
No, you're good.
Wholesale, and then flip. And then
So what was second? Yeah, number two.
Yeah, number two is wholetail. W-H-O-L-E and then T-A-I-L. I don't know if that's the official term. That's just what, you know, the kind of community that I'm in calls it. And that's like a, call it soft flip, call it just a turn and burn, where essentially you, Bo, are selling your property. Maybe it's full of stuff. Maybe you just don't want to deal with it anymore. Maybe it was a, you know, estate of some sort. And maybe there's a scary tree up in the front of the house or something like that. And so I buy it from you for $100,000. I close on it. I'll send a landscaper in, chop down that tree. I'll send one dumpster and one person, you know, day labor in there to clearing the house out. And I will put it back on the market the next day with, you know, on the MLS, essentially with my real estate team. And we'll put it back on, let's say, for, you know, $137,500 or whatever the number is, right? And we'll sell that to an end buyer. It could be an investor. It could be somebody who's going to live in the home, because the MLS historically will make more money. And we do a lot of those. I mean, those do really, really, really well. I used to have this theory and belief that you had to flip the house once you bought it. And it's just not true. Somebody else is willing to take it on.
This is, you actually close, you have to deploy money, but you clean it up and you have a very short hold period and not a lot of money put into the property.
That's correct.
Then we have full flip.
Full flip. That's my game. I mean, I'm like, dude, I'm a ninja flipper. I believe in my flips. I love my flips. They're awesome. They're sexy. They sell like hotcakes. My average flip in the last 2 years has sold like $26,000 over the asking price. And we crush it on flips. Going back to, you know, last year's numbers, we netted way over $1 million last year just in flips alone.
Hmm. That's wild.
How many did you do?
Last year we did 14 full flips.
And if you follow Kobe on social, you can see you just bought one for, what was it, $10,000?
Yeah, we did a burn down property. Yeah, that was rough. I wouldn't suggest to buy a burn down house. That was like a, maybe that went back to the hustler mindset of like, I can do anything.
Yeah, I was going to say there's one more after the full flip, right?
Yeah, so after the full flip, it's like, do you want to buy it as a rental, right? So, you know, if you bought the property as a rental, what do you want it to net? So for me, I really just look at like net dollars in my pocket. You could look at a cash on cash rate. You could look at an IRR, however you want to look at it. But really, you know, on average for me, I want to net between $500 and $600 per month on that rental. That could change based off your market and where you are and all that kind of stuff. And then the last piece is, do I do an owner finance deal? So do I buy the home right? Close on the home, maybe clean it up a little bit, maybe not, put it right back on the market, offer owner financing to somebody who wouldn't get qualified through a typical bank. And I do really well on those. My average return is 24% plus on those deals. I think it's 24.5% right now on the deals that I have of those. That you're deploying a lot more of your own cash, right? There's ways to get out of it, but you're deploying a lot more cash. I think the biggest thing though is if you're listening to this and you're like, man, that's just a lot going on. Think about what your deal hierarchy is today. So like if you're selling homes as a realtor, your deal hierarchy is you have one piece of it, right? You can list the house. If you own a rental, you have two pieces of the deal hierarchy, right? Like you could buy it as a rental or you could list it on the market. If you flip homes and you own a couple rentals and you're a realtor, maybe you have three pieces. And so you're just expanding your repertoire, which helps you mitigate against risk in the market and allows you to run really fast and hard at all different types of deals to kind of slice and dice as you go. And it can be really, really lucrative because just as a flipper, I was turning down so many opportunities that I could have been making money for in other places or with in other places, if that makes sense.
You're growing your income, you're growing your cash flow, so many different things. Now, for somebody who wants to just start, they want to either flip their first house, I don't recommend wholesaling right away because that's really difficult to find, not really difficult, but it's difficult to find your end buyer and make sure that you do things the right way. But for someone that wants to take on their first flip, whether it's a light flip or a full flip, how do you evaluate that deal? What goes through your head? What is a good deal?
Yeah.
What is average repair costs? Things like that.
Yeah, I would look at what your market is, right? So what's selling really, really well in your market? What's the home look like? What's the condition of the home? What does it actually look like? So just start analyzing your market. Last year, like what flips have sold? There's usually in every like metropolitan market, right? There's going to be flips that sold and that are, you know, kind of like your house that you might be looking at, right? And then figure out like what you need to actually do to it to get it to sell for that price. Based off of that, you want to look at like, okay, so there's the, what can you pay for it? Well, based off the condition, what's the on-market value in today's condition? Then what's the on-market value in flipped condition? And then what can you actually buy it for? In terms of construction costs, you know, you might need to get a couple contractors in there. One thing I would say is your retail contractor is not going to be your contractor for a flip. Right? One of my best strategies when I didn't have any contractors was I'd go to Home Depot between like 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. Right? Don't find the guys that are waiting outside for a job. Go inside, go to like the sheetrock area, go to the painting area, go to the, you know, area where there's like actual guys like, you know, picking up, you know, three carts of doors or whatever. And be like, hey, what do? You a contractor? I have a job I'm looking at here. Like, what do you, show me some of the work you've done. And so that's one of the best ways I've found contractors over time is like the actual people doing the jobs. And, you know, once you figure out what it's going to cost to do that renovation, you have to factor it in. So let's say you can end sale the property. Let's say $250,000 is what you could sell it on the end price, right? Which I understand, you know, Daniel, in your market, you can't do. Northeast Ohio, you can, right? So end sale price is $250,000. Then we figure out construction cost is going to be $50,000. Then we figure out the holding cost, closing cost, taxes, commissions, cost of, let's say, your loan. If you have to take a loan on the property, is going to be $25,000, right? So we take $250,000 minus the $50,000 of construction minus the $25,000 of the other stuff. So now we have another $25,000 of expenses. So we have $75,000 total. So now we're at, you know, are you guys calibrating with me here?
Yeah, $175,000.
Okay. $175,000.
So $175,000, yeah. Right. So hold with me here. So we're at $175,000 and now we got to figure out how much profit we want. So if we want $50,000 in profit, the maximum I can pay without there being any mistakes on this deal is $125,000. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to figure out my offer based off that. Now, you got to know if it's your first couple months, I'd leave some, you know, room to make errors. And I wouldn't take on a deal where you go on a good day, I'd make $20,000, because if there's one thing that happens, that's what I see a lot of flippers make mistakes on. They go, well, for the first one, I'm okay just making $20,000. And I go, well, I'm good with that too. As long as you believe there's $50,000 of room. So when you make a $30,000 mistake via three $10,000 mistakes, you're making $20,000, not you're making $20,000. So when there's that amount of mistakes, now you're losing money.
Kobe, I think this is one of the most important points for people who are getting into stuff. I think it's like, I call it like the sort of the typical new entrepreneur, like paradox. And it's what kills every new entrepreneur, which is that expenses, if you estimate expenses, they usually are what you estimated or slightly higher. And we tend to be pretty good at estimating our expenses, whether it's On a flip, sometimes things come up that are surprising, that that's a risk on a flip. But in like a business, we estimate the expenses really well. And then we estimate our revenue. And our revenue can fluctuate. But in the flip, it could be your expenses that fluctuate. We're not prepared for the typical fact. And the earlier you are in a process, the more likely you are to make a mistake. And
oh, so for sure.
When you're starting a business or you're starting an initiative or you're flipping your first house, the chances of you messing up are actually really high. And I love that you're saying, okay, like, let's just put a number on that and let's build it in. So it would be okay for us to make less money, but it's not okay for us to plan to make less money without knowing that our plan is likely going to be a plan that doesn't actually play itself out.
So many people jump into thinking like they're willing to pay for a learning experience, which is great, but I want you to win the first time. And then we're going to go create a repeatable model around it, right? That gets you, again, the repeatable model, systems, processes is what gets you out of being the hustler, you know, to becoming the CEO or becoming the business owner. That's just, it's just a different vibe. I mean, then there's just problems that happen. I just had a flip last week, you know, there's a toilet on the second floor, furnaces in the basement, there's an air duct right by the toilet. Plumber picks up the toilet to replace it, right? About 2 gallons of water that was in the toilet somehow ends up down the HVAC vent, which breaks the HVAC, okay? Because of that, it ended up being like a $6,000 expense we weren't planning on, right? And so, and it wasn't his fault per se, it just like, this happened, right? And so now it's like, okay, $6,000. Now if you had a $20,000 potential profit, you just lop that up. All of a sudden, it's like, it just goes down and down and down, and all of a sudden you're paying to do a flip, and that's just not a fun place to be.
I think even now more so with homes that are staying longer, buyer concessions that are needing to be given, like your exit and how you get out of this, if you build it really conservative. I mean, this is why we call my wife over budget, because there's no project that she's ever done within the budget that we both agreed upon. I kid you not, I'm still in this thing of getting her license plate that says over budget on her car, because it's just, it's difficult. I get it. But how do you anticipate the challenges, Kobe? What do you think through, or how do you just pad every expense by 10 or 15%?
I think you have to pad the expenses. And I think the other thing you have to do is you have to know what you're buying. So, you know, if you're new, I would do an inspection on the front end, like a general home inspection. And then one thing we do is right before we list the property, we actually do a general home inspection on the back end too. So let's say it's 2 days before we list property, general home inspection. We put that inspection on the MLS. And we let the end buyer see what the home is. So we're like disclosing everything. That way they don't have an inspection. And then during, you know, the removal contingency period, you know, that like intermediate period where they're negotiating, they hit us for somewhere between $3,000 and $10,000 for something that they saw in person. Like sometimes we'll flip a home. Yeah. We won't change out the HVAC. We won't change out the hot water tank. We won't change out the electrical panel. Right. And we're not hiding that. Like, it's like, you could see when you go there, like, these are not new. Yet during the inspection period, they hit you and then you end up giving a $7,000 or $10,000 credit. And so what we do is we'll do a general home inspection right beforehand, and that mitigates a lot of these issues.
That's good.
I think the biggest problem people have is the mindset, like there's all these limiting beliefs. And I think some of the limiting beliefs people have is like, well, I don't have the money for it. And I had that limiting belief for sure for a very long time of like, well, when I have, I used to like dream about the idea of like having like $500,000 in the bank so I could go flip homes. And that just never happened. I just never had this dream time where I sold enough houses till there's just $500,000 of cash in the bank sitting there for me to go do something fun. And so, you know, in that case, what I had to go do is figure out how to go find the money. And over the years, I think that's one of the things that's made me successful is I've always found a way to find the money. But I think the reason why I found the money is because I've always been able to justify that I actually found a deal. And so the same way we backed into that deal before, I could go to somebody and say, hey, Daniel, I want you to invest this money with me or for me on behalf of me, you know, as a loan or whatever it is. Here's the deal and the opportunity. And even if I mess up, I believe I'm still in the green. Mm-hmm. And so if you find the deal, you're going to find the money. And so many people come up to me who know what I do. And they're like, because, you know, we did over 100 investment deals last year. And I get a lot of DMs, a lot of questions like, I really want to get into it, blah, 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 but I can't find the money. And I'm like, find the deal. I'll help you find the money. That's easy.
Right.
Now I fundraise, just so you guys know, like I have kind of a private fundraise that I do, and I borrow money from essentially family, friends, a couple of small family offices. They lend to me directly on my deals. They're not partners on my deals. They just lend to me. But beforehand, I like, you go to a hard money lender, you go wherever. And then the other thing people say is, well, hard money is so expensive. And I go, well, yeah, but you know, even if you had to pay 20% on the deal, but you were going to net 50K, wouldn't that 20% make sense? Like people are so focused on the interest rate. They go, well, I don't want to do this because the money is so expensive. And I go, well, you have to look at the deal. The money is just a relative factor of that deal.
And that's part of the thing with wholesaling and everything. I get, everyone's got to eat. This is not a space where one person wins and other people lose. Like there's an opportunity to hard money lender. He's going to get his 15%, 12%, but I'm also going to make my 30, 50,000 on the flip, right?
For sure. And also it's like, you might have a 15%, you know, interest rate, but don't forget that if you're only holding that property for 4 to 6 months, you're not paying 15%. Like,
right.
Just something to think about.
Now, as we wrap up, we talk about all the great things that you've done and now you've built an incredible business, Kobe. But what I want to know, what is the biggest mistake you made? What is the biggest challenge, biggest mistake, biggest mishap that literally cost you a bunch of money or a bunch of time?
I think there's one that's in my head and one that's reality, right? The one that's in my head was believing that I wasn't worthy of it. I think there was just this long period of time where I just like, I knew I could sell something. Once I realized I really wanted to have a net worth and I really wanted to grow business, I really wanted to become, you know, a man and a business owner and a good father and all those types of things, I think there was this element of like, can I look in the mirror and be worthy of that? And I've had to build up my mind over time to where I can look in the mirror and go like, no, no, Kobe, like you're worthy of this. You're allowed to have this, right? You have the ability to go get this. No one's holding back but you. So you can't hold back. Like, I got this. And I think it goes back to like the early days in Bold, right? If you took like Bold, which like business by, what is it? Business objectives, life by design, right? And so it's like going back to that, like realizing that like, no, like I'm worthy of having something. And I think being unworthy or maybe having the perception or believing that I was unworthy for a certain amount of time held me back from achieving some of the goals and dreams and aspirations that I had. In a real situation is the first couple of deals that I did on flips and rentals is I lied to myself about the numbers. I would go like, oh, this roof sold me $5,000. It's like, there's no $5,000 roof. The roof is 10,000, right? Of like, oh, like I can do this whole flip for $25,000, forgetting that there's like holding costs. Well, what happens if, you know, your contractors in the winter where, you know, we have big winters here. So it's like, if they leave the windows open, well, they paint and they blast the heat. Now you have a $2,000 heat bill. What happens if, you know, the sink is left on and you have an $800 water bill? Like what your insurance on a flip is a little more expensive. Like I wasn't calculating all the holding, closing, taxes, commissions, all those other expenses. So I even lied to myself on the first couple flips that I was net profit and it was like profitable, but that wasn't true. Like, and so I think we can lie to ourselves on the numbers because we get emotional about the deal. We get really excited about it. And I've had to learn to become unemotional and really strict with the math.
Kobe, you're a wealth of knowledge and you explain everything really good. I think it's been great to have you and to listen to you go step by step of exactly how you've built such an amazing business. Thanks for being here.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been awesome to have you. I love the framework. I love the cascading. That like that is such a great way to think about it because I think we're so trapped in one mindset and then optionality scares us. But you've sort of built that into a system and a framework that has powered that. Thanks for sharing that with us and bringing all your energy and perspective.
No, I mean, it means a lot to me. I mean, to be invited here is cool. And I've been listening to you guys and kind of following along. And I saw you guys at a, you know, family reunion this year. So that was cool. I think the goal of figuring out like what you want later in life is a lot harder than people think. But if you can figure that out and then figure out where you are, then you can figure out where you want to go. And as long as along the way, you believe you're worthy of that end goal, I think the opportunity is endless.
That's a great way to wrap. I was going to ask you for one thing, and I think that was perfect. Awesome.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for coming on. Until next time, friends, Color Money Podcast. Talk to you soon.
Follow the Color of Money Podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.